Hi, everyone, and welcome back to RPG R&D. I am one of your hosts. My name is Jess Geyer. I am one half of Wannabe Games, and I make tabletop role-playing games and LARPs. And I'm here, as always, with my co-host, Craig Campbell. Hello, Craig.
Hi, Jess. I am Craig Campbell. I am the owner of Nerdburger Games, and I also make tabletop role-playing games and a card game. And so we're just going to hit all of our plus one things that we do. But we've got a brand new guest, everybody, somebody who hasn't been here before. Welcome, Chase.
Hello. I am Chase Krakowski. I'm a software developer, tabletop game maker, and a photographer here in the Chicago area. I've made a couple of video games. I've made a couple of tabletop games, and I've been making tabletop games a little bit more seriously as of late. So,
yeah, with do you want to say what your company's
story
name is?
so our we have a little design collective is kind of how we've branded ourselves, called Story Games Chicago. There are a bunch of designers here locally. That's a good point. I should have mentioned this. You're right. Thank you for calling that out.
But I have Vesta mandate right here on my table.
Oh, that's awesome. Thank you. And so we're a bunch of designers here locally in Chicago. And we initially got started making City of Blood and Plaster, which was a system agnostic setting zine based on the 1893 Chicago World's Fair. About a year and a half, 2 years ago now. And that was kind of just, you know, we were playing a bunch of games together and we were like, what if we made some games? Because we're all creative. We have a bunch of ideas. And then it kind of snowballed from there. Two of us from that group made a game called Vesta Mandate that is finishing up fulfillment right now for a couple of people, especially like international people should be getting their books soon. But a lot of people have already gotten them. So excited to hear more from people who are getting those. And then we're continuing to make games. So check those accounts if you want to see our stuff. But we're just making all sorts of stuff. We got crazy, weird political sci-fi stuff. We've got weird, you know, occult, you know, historic stuff and all sorts of things. So,
yeah. Well, again, Chase, thanks for coming on the podcast. And we have a topic that can sometimes be the bane of existence for many game designers like us. Craig, what are we talking about today?
We're going to be talking about iterating your game and your game design and playtesting it, and how those things kind of tie together, and what are some best practices and tactics that we've used. This is one of those topics that it's incredibly specific to the game designer. There are some game designers who playtest the absolute hell out of games and they grind down to things. And there are some designers who are much more fast and loose, and they want to, like, if they get the vibe right, they're not as concerned about whether or not the mechanics do like a very, very specific thing. So, you know, iterating this the game system can mean a lot of things, and playtesting can mean a lot of things. And so we're just going to touch on as much as we can in an hour. And I guarantee you, before the end of the hour, one of us will say, we could talk about this for 7 hours or something akin to that, because this is one of those topics.
Yeah.
What? So what kind of playtesters are we? Are we really, really thorough playtesters, or?
I'm both, actually. It depends entirely on the game that I'm making. And something that Craig said in that intro that I think is actually so true is, and when you were saying that, Craig, you framed it as like designer based on whether or not they're going for the vibe or the mechanic. And I think sometimes, and I think this is something that more people should take to heart, is like, sometimes that depends on what the kind of game you're trying to make is, right? Like, mm-hmm. If you're trying to make the next 5e or whatever, the next sort of crunchy, or maybe like GURPS or Pathfinder are better examples. If you're trying to make games that are crunchier, have a lot more mechanics, have a lot more systems interacting with each other and interchanging, then having that like playtesting going on, especially a lot to make sure those systems work together, or if you're making board games or things like that, where you want there to be, you know, a bit of a balance to it, then those things matter way more. If you are going primarily for the vibes more than the hard, crunchy mechanics that like get a very specific outcome, then I don't know that playtesting always is the thing that you need to hit so much. But I think that varies game to game. So I think that is kind of where I tend to land on it.
And I think that real quick note that even with vibey games, there's a certain level of testing, which may not be play testing, like, like, you know, working out the mechanics, but there's a certain amount of testing that, like, if you're trying to make sure that you're getting the right vibe across, that the game kind of plays and feels a certain way, and that all the players are going to latch onto that very easily from reading the game, or the, you know, if one person reads it and then they have to kind of pass that information along to the other players, then it can be, doing tests of the text and just getting the text into different people's hands and iterating how you present the information so that it gets the point across. And then you can say, okay, read through how to play this game and then let's talk. And I'm going to, and then you can ask questions or whatever. And they can tell you kind of what they got for a feel for the game when they ran the game, how did other people react to it? Like what groove did they fall into? And you can do that. You can test the, you can test the vibe.
Totally.
By just how you present everything.
Definitely can test the vibe. I think sometimes the vibe has to be tested. Like, you might think that, like, oh, yeah, they totally get this. They're totally going to get it. How are they not going to get it? And then you get it down in front of players, and, like, they just do not. Mm-hmm. They completely miss the point, or they turn what you thought was supposed to be like a serious game to a silly one. You're like, okay, well, was this just normal player shenanigans, or was this a fault of how I have stuff set up? Was it a fault of the GM? Like, there are all sorts of things that, like, you could look at for, like, specifically that vibe. I'm very much a vibes playtester. Mm-hmm. The vibe for me is more important than the rules itself, and I know that that might seem sacrilegious to a lot of game designers, but that's because I usually don't have to worry about the mechanics. I have a design partner who will do that for me, and I can just be the vibes person. Not that I can't design a mechanic, but I come from a tradition of rules less
totally
role playing. So
yeah.
That's the beauty of a partnership like that, is you can actually you can handle both, and each person can kind of do the thing that they like.
In the board game community, there's actually a bit of a debate sometimes on whether or not, well, and actually this extends outside of the board game community, but it's where I most often see people talking about this, on how useful is balance? Like, how much does balance aid in making a fun game, right? And so, like, even that, beyond just thinking about, like, getting a game to a table and actually figuring out, like, do the vibes play out well? Even when you are sitting down and designing, like, a board game that isn't something that is more about the vibes, or, and sometimes it is, like, there are board games that are very vibey, but considering how much balance and the actual, like, making sure that the two sides are on equal footing or whatever actually matters for the experience that you're trying to build, I think is also something that is kind of important. And I think those are things that are pretty huge too. And people still debate that all the time. Like, there are some people who are diehard balance is the killer of fun game experiences. And but I think one of the biggest things for me, honestly, is the idea of getting a game to the table as soon as possible. Like, once you know you have the central core element of it, just as quickly as you can, getting it in front of someone. And that can be like what Craig was saying, get the rules text in front of someone and say, like, hey, can you do a read through on this? And let me know, does it read like, actually just let me know what you think, and then we'll talk about it later. Or getting it down to a table and just throwing it in front of some players and being like, what'd you think? Because then you very quickly see, is this at all what I thought it was going to be?
Yeah, that's like such a huge, I think it's important just to try to get your ideas out too and like published as soon as possible, because I see a lot of people who sit on a game for years and years and years and years, and by that time you're not the same person making the game now that you were when you started making the game. And like Alex went to a video game meetup, actually. My husband and my design partner, for those people who do not listen to this podcast very often or don't know me, went to a video game meetup and was talking to some video game designers. And he asked one of them, like, oh, is this going to be your best game? And of course they say no, like, but this game isn't going to be my best game. So why aren't you just going to like start getting it out there? If you want to move on to the next best thing, you're not going to make this one perfect, right? Let's keep going. I mean, I think some people will, we have the same habit, I think, in tabletop game spaces where we sit on an idea and we write it and write it and write it and try to make it perfect before anybody else even sees it for the first time. And then some people get stuck in a playtest loop too, like, oh, this isn't it exactly, and just keep going. And you're designing a game, but now very few people are actually ever going to get to play it. And it's okay to make a game that is not, especially for a tabletop game, that is not necessarily the most perfect rule set that you can get. There's a lot of things that we can do as players. Like, should you have a rule set that works? Yeah, you should. And you want to make sure that it does hit, and maybe you want to scrap the game entirely. Who knows? I think, like, just the idea of not sitting with something for too long is going to help your creative process in general. It's a snowball process. You publish something, you're going to want to publish more things. It's going to get better and better and better. Whereas if you sit and stagnate with it, it's going to be a melted snow puddle of stinky swamp water.
I think ash cans and things like that are a huge way that people can push. Like, if you're working on a project and you feel like it deserves more of your time and energy, one of the best things I think you can do is put it out into the world in whatever finished state you can get it to, even if you don't think it's as good as it can be. Start getting it in front of people, start getting feedback on it. Hear what people like actually think about it, because you're gonna, over the course of that time, you're gonna be like, oh, here's 40 other things that I would actually do instead of the stuff I was thinking before, because now I've had more time to make other mistakes and learn new things and iterate on other projects. And now my brain is in a different place. Like, so many of the decisions we make are so rooted in like the people we are at the time that we make them, which is maybe a silly statement, but it's so true that, like, you're designing as the person you are today. So coming back to something in the future, you're designing as someone who has more experience, who's worked on a thing longer, who has more experience putting out more games, more experience failing, which is how we learn at things. And I think a lot of that is a huge part of why I totally agree with you in the sense that, like, put out an ash can of your game. If it's the kind of thing that you feel like you can't put down, put out an ash can, come back to it later. I think Realis did a really good job of this, putting out their original ash can version. And I mean, they made it very clear that they were like, this is just an ash can. We want to do something bigger with this, but here's like what we have now. And there are a lot of games that do stuff like that. And I think it's a great way to start, A, building a community, which is important if you want it to actually be like, financially or commercially successful. But the flip side of that too is it gives you a lot of time to percolate on the ideas and see what people like and what they don't like. So I think all of that's good.
For the it also gives you breathing time for your creativity.
For those not aware, the term ash can, I think originally came from comic books, if I'm correct on that. But it's basically come to mean, like, for any creative work, it's like, here's a bare bones proof of concept of the thing. Like, here's just for a game, it might be like, here's a bit of setting, here's the basic rules, here's some characters, here's a little story idea or something that you can run. And it's, and it's often like a little thin kind of zine, almost zine style or zine thickness kind of game book. And it just dips its toe and kind of it allows you to get a conversation going with the people who are picking up, trying it out. And if you can build like any sort of community around that ash can and get kind of playtest feedback from people looking at just that bare bit, just the core of the game, and then like what both of my co-hosts here have been saying, like that might last, that might take, you might have that out there for a couple months and then you come back to it. It might sit there for a year and you just have this like lovely little discussion going back and forth, and you discover all sorts of ideas from things people are saying. And then you also d discover the, come across the ideas that you just, you discover as you read and play other games, and your view of different types of systems changes over time and so forth. And to speak to Jess's comment about just get something out there, this is something that comes up whenever we talk about iteration and playtesting is, and I get it from people asking my advice every now and then, where they say, how do you know when the game is done? And my response to that is kind of a two-pronged approach, which is one, you just know. you just feel like, okay, this is the point where I could improve it a little bit, but is it worth all the time and effort to go through to improve that little bit? And then that's, you know, ties into where we as people who could iterate something to death will say things like, perfect is the enemy of finished. Like, if you want to get it done and put into some people's hands so that they can enjoy the fruits of your creative labor, sometimes you just got to say, all right, that's as good as it's going to get.
I can
always come back and do a rules expansion and tweak some stuff. I can always do a second edition. I can always iterate that game system into another game with a different genre or whatever, which is, I speak from experience at having tweaked little parts of a game system through four different genres of games now. Yeah, there's so much you can do.
Yeah, when we were wrapping up, well, honestly, all throughout like the back half of Vesta Mandate's design, Ryan and I the whole time were like, there's so many additional things that we're starting to think of and ideas that we have and all these cool concepts. And I just have like a couple of notes on my desk that are just like all of the ideas that we had to keep writing down in notes so they wouldn't keep like poisoning our mind, because they were basically big enough that they needed to be like 2E ideas. And, you know, you'd rabbit hole down on them for like an hour of conversation, be like, what if, what if, what if? And then you'd be like, we got to shut it down. We got to like actually focus on finishing this thing. Because like at a certain point, it's like exactly what you were saying. It can always be a 2E. It can always be some extension on it. There was a talk at my university from a guy who worked in, I don't remember what company, but he worked in game design at one of the bigger companies doing video games. And a comment that he made at one point was like, when are the games done? How do you know when the games are done? He was saying the same thing. And he was like, it's never done. If I could be sitting at the conveyor belt with the CDs are going out, etching new code into them, I would be doing it. And I feel very similarly to that, honestly, whenever I make anything, I'm like, I want to just continue working on it absolutely. Forever.
Oh, yeah. I think that that's a common experience, if not universal experience, for game designers or creatives of any type. Like, oh my gosh. Like,
yeah.
Like, people have, you know, the longer you look at something, the more you can see its flaws, or the longer that you're just sitting there and thinking about ideas for it. So, yeah, I totally get it. And it feels so permanent once you have it out in the world. It's really not so permanent. Mm-hmm. I know that there are like standards and history of like how we publish things. There's no law that says that you can't just like change something in your second printing and just continue calling it the same thing. There's no law there. I don't know how your audience will like that, but there's actually nothing in the books that say you can't do that in your book.
It's true. For the record, Jess and I have reviewed. We spent the last 2 weeks looking up and down all the books, and we reviewed, and there is no law. There really isn't.
We also contacted the RPG R&D lawyer. wouldn't it be really funny if we had one? yeah, it's so here's something interesting, like kind of getting into like how we play test. So I've been writing LARPs, and LARPs are very, very similar to TTRPGs in a lot of ways. Like, you know, you have mechanics, you have characters, you have you're doing role playing. It is a role playing game. But playtesting is so much more of a different beast. I can't do a thing that I do with my tabletop role-playing game playtesting, meaning like, okay, we're going to try out this rule, right? Just this rule. You can't do that with a LARP, because so much of, at least not the kind of LARPs that I make, because that it involves like, how do they engage in the story and how are they continuing to stay engaged without a GM continuously prompting them, because you can't really do that in a LARP.
Yeah.
And you have to get all these people together, and you have to have like the space to run. Like, you basically have to start it from start to finish if you want to do it in an effective way. And that is really tough. So you do have to have a lot of the process done before you even like try to have it out in front of people for the first time. You have to have a really good understanding of how a game works. And I think that that's the point number one of running a good playtest is, if this is your first game, make sure that you have played a lot of games that are like your game So you know, you've read the text, you've played the games, you know how it's supposed to go. And then you've already kind of ironed out a lot of the wrinkles before you get there. I mean, again, like I'm thinking about this LARP that I'm making right now, and there's some new stuff that we're doing, or at least new to me. And I'm hoping my experience tells me that it's not going to explode at hour two of this 5-hour LARP. I'm hoping.
Yeah, that sounds tough. I'm trying to think of other analogs of things. I guess the only thing I can really think of is video game playtests, where you really need, like, there are certain games that I can think of where you really need, like, the whole experience to mm-hmm. really get, like, parts of it. Mm-hmm. That's so tough. I think that would be hard, yeah, because you basically do just have to get everyone and have the whole time period, right? Like,
yeah, it's wild, and it's like any other role-playing game, you know, like a lot mm-hmm. of the same elements kind of apply. The only thing is that you're kind of doing things more on the fly and with less DM intervention, which is another thing that's so important in a playtest. If I'm playtesting something on a table and I'm a GM, I can make tweaks on the fly. You can't mm-hmm. really do that with a LARP. I actually did a playtest of a video game back in December called The Rat Line. It's a game about you're a private detective in the 70s and you're hunting down Nazis who fled to various parts of the world under
cool.
different names. It's really cool. It's by Owlskip Games. And that was kind of one of those similar games. Like, it has a storyline that goes through it, and it's a mystery-based game. Very Golden Idol-inspired, Oberdin-inspired style of game. And as I was playing it and giving feedback, the creator was changing things in the previous chapters, and then I would reload the game, and I'd be like, I don't know what the hell is happening. I have to start over again. But, you know, you could still play test, like, does this actual mechanic work? Do these clues make sense together? Like, that was all the stuff that we could do. And I learned a lot, actually, from playtesting that. Just, like, what kinds of things do you need ready before you have it in front of your playtester? Mm-hmm. As well as, like, what should you be telling your playtester to look for? I think having very specific questions for your playtester or playtesters is a good way to make sure that you're getting the feedback that you want, but making sure that it's open enough that they can tell you of something else that they noticed, because you don't know what they're going to notice. You're like blinders on, you know, when you're making a game. Having a specific question, I want to test this mechanic. Does this feel good? But also, hey, what else do you think? It was very interesting. This is the second playtest I've done for him. And I'm still kind of processing, like, how I can apply those lessons to my own game design. Video games are so different, you know.
Something too that from my time doing games stuff, we learned a lot about playtesting, doing games playtesting, because it can be regimented a lot more easily, because you can, you know, send out the game in a form to a bunch of different people or whatever. Mm-hmm. But like you said, having a good set of questions that focus on whatever the thing you're aiming for, writing good playtesting questions can be really hard, because it's so easy to lead questions. And this is the same when you're writing questions about anything, but it's so easy to lead questions in the direction that you like want them to go without even thinking about it, if you're not being very attentive to the questions that you're writing. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing too is like, kind of being hands off as much as possible when you're playtesting, like letting, and one of the best things that I have ever been able to do playtesting a game is having someone else GM it in front of me, and then being able to just sit back and take notes and them use the text and me just not say anything and watch it either succeed or go completely wrong on its own. Because you learn so much. You learn if your text is bad. You learn if your text is functional but has some issues. You learn kind of where those are. That obviously is like a later form of playtesting. I don't think that's what you do when you're first getting it to the table to see if it has the juice, but I think those kinds of playtests can be so useful. And that's sort of like when you get an ash can out or whatever, and you put it out in the world and you just start talking with people, that's mm-hmm. kind of similar.
Oh yeah. I have another playtest experience that, like, I have playtested a lot of games for other people. Mm-hmm. I do think it's really important to play test your game if you have like a really complex game. I don't think it really matters so much if your game's like, I'm not a huge play tester, I'll be honest with you. I will sometimes just do like a yeah, this works, go. And call it good. And then of course I play the game more and more and more and I'm like, ah, I'm gonna do this differently next time. But that's part of my process. I'm
Sure, yeah.
very, I'm not a, I can be a perfectionist in all of my other times in my life. My game design is one of the least serious things about me, on purpose. But I think it is important to make sure that somebody who's not your friends also look at your game. I've play tested for people and I'm like, how am I going to tell them in the nicest way possible that this sucks?
Yeah.
And they're my friend, and how can I do that? And they're still my friend at the end. I do a lot. Actually, you know what? I'm thinking about another experience with this. I was a beta reader for one of my friend's books. And when he gave me the book, I was like, please, 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 please don't suck. Don't suck. Well, how am I going to say if this sucks? Thank
Sure.
goodness. It was great. It was awesome. But I was thinking, like, how am I going to tell them if I like actually don't like it? Because I also want to be honest with them. I think it is
Yeah.
important, honest feedback. But yeah, making sure you're going to somebody who is either not afraid to like kind of do a little damage to your relationship, although you shouldn't take it serious. I personally, if you are getting play test feedback,
Yeah.
but you know, someone who's not afraid to like damage that, who will be honest with you and give you that feedback without maybe completely hurting your feelings forever.
Well, and I have two sort of solutions to that. And the first one might seem a little bit trite, but I think finding other artistic people who are comfortable with constructive criticism and good at giving constructive criticism, because that can also sometimes you'll find people who are comfortable with criticism, but aren't that isn't always constructive. Sometimes you'll find people that are like, I'm more than happy to shit on your game, and you can shit on my game, but it's not constructive, and that can also suck. But the other one is finding playtest groups that are not always just your friends. Like here in Chicago, Sean Four runs Playtest Chicago, which is a local playtest group that meets every other week. And it's been huge. Being able to just like pop in, play other people's games, but then also run your own game there, you know, every month or whatever is huge. Like that's such a good resource to be able to get your game in front of other designers or other people who are interested in design. I've gotten some incredible feedback. I've also gotten other designers there to run games for me. So finding a group like that or starting one, if you have a community that's big enough near you. The other thing is, so Story Games Chicago is a bunch of designers, obviously, and not this. Well, we did it this last winter too, but 2 winters ago, I guess, we went on a winter's retreat, and it was a writer's retreat basically over the winter, and it was our first time ever doing this, and the whole idea was like, let's do like time to go like be creative and write stuff, but also like have a bit of a vacation as well. So we literally just like went and locked ourselves in a cabin in Wisconsin for like 3 or 4 days, and over like the weekend right around New Year's or whatever. And we just wrote games, play tested games, talked about games, cooked food, all that sort of stuff. It was a fantastic time. And we play tested like a game a day, basically. It was crazy. And two or three of the games we play tested were made at that retreat. Like we literally, people were like finished writing a game and they were like, can I play test this tomorrow? And the instant feedback loop of like, I came up with an idea that I've been thinking about for, you know, months. I finally wrote it down, cleaned some stuff up. Can we get it to the table right now? And then immediately seeing, was this a good idea? Yes or no? What's good? What's bad? Huge. If you have like a creative group, or if you can cultivate a creative group around you, I would 1000% recommend doing things like that. Even if it's just spend a day with your friends playtesting a bunch of stuff. Like it's a lot of fun. It helps cultivate your ability to see what's fun and what's not in those games. It's huge. So those both of those things I think are huge for all of this, but
I mean, we should not underestimate the power of a writer's retreat. And every writer's retreat needs one Byron, one John Polidori, and one Mary Shelley. Everyone needs that in their group. And then you get to create a whole new genre
yeah.
of writing. That's a Frankenstein joke.
Everybody loves a good Frankenstein joke.
I find that a lot of my playtesting takes place. I've kind of avoided the like be in the room with the group, especially after I've gotten kind of known. Like the people kind of know me, and I mostly just get worried. And this doesn't have to be your problem. You may not experience this at all. I get worried that like having the creator of the game in the room might influence how the people talk about things, and how they discuss things, and whether they tell you the brutal truth about some things. But you get the benefit of like being able to be there and have a conversation. So it's like you just have to figure out like what's more important to you, you having no influence or having that conversation. But I also find that when it comes to like Chase was commenting about playtest questions being leading is that is a I agree wholeheartedly that that is hard to avoid. It's very easy to try to even trying to go like I'm going to create this question and it's going to be like completely neutral and it's going to just get nice clean results and you just accidentally do it in such a way that it provides excuse one direction or the other. So that's mostly a question of kind of iterating your questioning, like, and it might be changing up your question completely. Like I'm not going to ask this question at all. I'm going to ask this other question, or it might be, I'm going to ask this question in a slightly different way because I asked it here before. I fully expected there to be like dividing lines and people to have very different opinions, and they all kind of came down on the same side. And I'm like, I have to think, did the way I write it cause it to all kind of come down on the same side when I fully expected to get a wider variety of responses. And so, it's a question of kind of going through that process. And that can be difficult. It can be frustrating. And it's very easy to not know if you're actually improving anything in your questioning process. But if you're asking different questions at different times with different groups, with different levels of experience who have different play styles, you will hopefully at least get a smattering of a wide variety of responses to all your questions that you can then cultivate. You can go through, you can kind of curate like, well, which of these responses are things that like really help me hone in on a particular area? Which of these responses are like where they're talking more about the vibe and how do I have to kind of adjust how that's presented? Which of these responses are people going, hey, you have a real problem here? And being honest with yourself and being willing to take the hit, that, oh yeah, there is a real problem here. There was a very, very real problem that got solved in the tail end of the Kickstarter for Slay to Win because I had somebody who was playing the game in the very tail end before we did any final tweaks to the cards and we're be able to go to print pretty quickly after the Kickstarter wrapped up. And somebody said, you've got a situation that can arise. It would be very rare, but when it arises, it fucks the game hard. It really makes the and I was like, oh, that is bad because yes, it's a rare condition, it's a rare situation, but it's going to be the situation that gets talked about if
Sure,
and when it
yeah.
does come up, because we live in the internet age. So here's a whole new rule to accommodate this weird edge case that could make the game kind of unplayable,
Yeah.
or at least boring. If it's not unplayable, it's boring.
See,
So
that's one of the
you
kinds of
never
games
know
where
when
it's
you're going to
like,
find it.
yeah. I mean, that's a kind of game where there's like a lot of rules interlocking with each other. You have to kind of make sure that it does work in all those different scenarios. Cards is
I was
so
going to say any
random.
card game you're looking at
Yeah.
more what well, and something that you mentioned that I think is I have heard a lot of designers say this and I have found it to be true in my experience as well. And it's interesting because your example actually doesn't follow this piece of advice, but I think often it is true is this idea that playtesters are often very good at identifying that there is a problem, but they're often not very good at identifying exactly what the problem is. Well, and I guess that's kind of true in your situation too, right? Because the playtester didn't go, you need exactly this rule to fix this problem. They went, there's a big problem here. So it's kind of true in your situation as well. But
yeah,
the example for this is like, you know, a playtester says, this feels horrible. I hate it. Fix it this way. And you're like, that fix makes no sense. It doesn't fit the game. It doesn't fit whatever, whatever. And that's a thing that I think is pretty common from playtesters. Mm-hmm. It's very easy for someone who's playtesting to throw out an idea for how to fix something. And often that's not like a ill will kind of thing. It's just, oh, I have a cool idea for how to fix this, right? And they're not the person who has like been in the trenches designing the game. So they're not tied into all of the reasons why that might not work for the game. But I think that idea of playtesters are good at figuring out something's not working, they're not always good at figuring the exact thing, is something that's great to keep in mind as a designer, because you want to, if a playtester says that like this doesn't work, you should listen to them. Like that is a red flag. Mm-hmm. You should look at it deeper. But it doesn't always mean that like they said do it this way, I gotta listen, right? So, and I don't think most people think that's true anyway, but it's just something good to keep in mind.
Yeah, and I think too, you want to make sure that that experience is good for your playtester, because you want them to come back.
Yeah.
If they give you an idea and you shoot it down in the wrong way, they're not going to want to playtest for you anymore. People like to feel like they're being helpful and smart. They like, if they give you a suggestion, you don't have to listen to it. That's you don't have to take their advice for how to fix something, but you can't just be like, no, that's dumb.
And I have had playtesters who have had really good ideas too.
Right. So. Of course. And you want to like, you know, you want to encourage that. You want to foster that kind of community. You want to foster the goodwill between you and your playtester.
Yeah.
You want them to feel smart. You want them to feel involved in the game. And you want to treat them with respect. So you also have to be giving kind of feedback to them back. Like, mm-hmm. thank you for the suggestion. I'm going to keep that in my notes. I'll try that out. I'll let you know how it goes. Or like, oh yeah, I've tried something like that. Thank you for the feedback. Figure out those ways that you like. Yes, you need to be able to take constructive feedback. You also need to be able to take feedback that is unhelpful without letting them know that it was very unhelpful.
Yeah.
Because as soon as you make them feel like they're unhelpful, they will not want to help you anymore. Another way that you can make your playtesters like want to come back to is, Chase, I'd love for you to tell a little bit more about like the, because I haven't been to the Chicago playtest one, or I've been to a couple playtest communities, but like, you could, of course, pay a playtester, but not all of us have that. I certainly can't afford to just pay my playtesters every time I playtest a game. But doing things like offering them, like, I will give you a copy of this game because you helped playtest it. Mm-hmm. I'll put your name in the book as credits as a playtester. That's really cool. I forgot how cool that was until I remembered that my name's in the Marvel game. And I was like, oh, yeah, my name's in that book now. How cool.
That is
cool. like making sure that you are, you know, not overwhelming them with questions, not like giving them an easy way to feedback, giving them not a hugely tight deadline, all those things that are going to make them want to come back to be your playtester. Otherwise, you will run out of playtesters.
There's always the classic for broke game designers of invite a bunch of people over, order a pizza,
yes,
playtest, eat pizza.
That's payment.
Yeah,
payment. It's like moving house. Yeah,
And like, you know, if we were all wealthy, I would love to pay all of my playtesters very well to play my games. I think that would be fantastic. But in such a world, I would do many things differently. Like also probably not have that wealth because I would immediately spend it all on the people around me. But
billionaire loses all of their billions so fast because of five playtests.
Yeah, funneling it all into the community around them. Oh, no. And to your question about the local Chicago community, it truly is. It's basically just an open table playtest group where anyone can submit a game to run. And then there's just a biweekly docket of the games that are going to be run. And if nothing gets submitted, Sean runs a couple of like various one-shot games that he's been interested in playing. And so they have like, it's been growing a lot recently. The Discord's been growing a lot for it. If you want to jump in it, just hit me up. Just go on. If you're in Chicago, if you're local to Chicago and you're interested in this and you want to go playtest games, just like shoot me a message online. I can get you into it, or send Sean for a message. He's also on like Blue Sky and all that. So it is literally just like, please come play test games. It's open invite, but it's nothing like too sophisticated beyond that. So.
And I imagine that it has like also kind of that sense of community. Like that's the kind of stuff that keeps bringing people back, you know?
Yep. And I've met some designers through that I've started to become friends with, because, you know, we're going to this event, you know, every couple of weeks, and I haven't gone to the last couple because I've been too busy, but it's one of those things where like, I want to keep going because I like building that relationship with some other designers who are local, and it's very cool. So.
There are also playtest spaces in certain conventions too. I'm thinking of like Double Exposure, the Unpub space. A lot of times that is more conducive to board game playing, because again, like RPGs can sometimes take a while. Like a session of an RPG can take some time. You know, some people will find a sweet spot with a session of 3 hours, 4 hours, right? And that's a long time to be like, hey, come play this untested game with me. Who knows if it's gonna go crash and burn. But people are there for those spaces to like try stuff out, and they're like there to give feedback. And then like, I mean, I feel so lucky living in Chicago because I'm never for want of community or events. But I'm thinking about people who don't necessarily have that. If you're in another city of any moderate size, you can always make your own. You're not the only game designer in your area. We also have, there's online spaces too, that you could certainly join. I haven't had the need to join any of those because I have an in-person space, which I prefer. I think finding and fostering that kind of community is so important for game designers, not just for playtesting, but also to make friends, Chase, like you said, like make other game designer friends, and make networking. Like that can really kind of make or break not just your like career path as a game designer, but your games themselves. You're going to be a better game designer if you know cool game designers.
Well,
you're going to want to compete with them.
it's about winning, actually.
Yes, actually.
we're definitely spoiled in Chicago. There's so many great designers. There's so many great players. There's such a big tabletop community here. But yeah, like you said, I mean, in almost every community, there are going to be people like that. You just have to have someone who is spearheading, like pulling those people together. And you just have to have people who are willing to do that work. And a lot of times that's a lot of unpaid upfront work that you just kind of have to do to build that community. And but it's very fulfilling if you're willing to put that work in. So
fulfilling. Here's a great person in everybody's town. They have this one person, and they have this interesting name. It's called a librarian. And they are usually really, really interested in getting more people to come to the library. And they, every city I've ever lived in, has had organizations and groups like you can have these events there at the library for free, and anyone can come there, and they really like that you're there. And that's not just a Chicago thing. That happened in my tiny town of Sturgis, Michigan as well. And that has 11,000 people, and librarians like to have people there and having community events. So even if you think like, oh, there's no spot for me, like there's no cool cafe, or like I don't want to pay a bunch of money. Libraries are also free. They're not free. You're paying taxes on them already. You're already paying for it. So
might as well use them.
Yeah.
It's worth noting too that the even if you go to a convention or something or a game day where there's a bunch of people signing up with different things, there are people out there who would love nothing more than to play test something that they've never seen before.
Oh, yeah.
And so you don't necessarily need to go to a convention that has, you know, a dedicated playtesting mechanism or room or, you know, organization. You can simply put the title of your event with the word playtest after a hyphen, and then, you know, note in the description that this is a playtest of blah, 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 blah. And there will be people who will gravitate toward that. You'll get some people who will be like, nah, I'm not interested in that. And that's good, because you don't want people who don't want to playtest at your playtest. But there will be people who will be like, ooh, try out something completely new. Like, here, I'm playing this game I know, and I'm playing in this game I know, and I'm playing this one that I know enough about that I'm interested. And here's this thing that's just going to be an experiment for me. I'll take a chance on that.
Yeah, I'm one of those people. I love to play test new games. I love to see what people are doing, and then I love to steal their ideas. So again, not like actual full ceiling. I just like to be inspired. I love the social aspect of gaming. And like I said too at the beginning, like the more games you play that are similar to either in vibe, theme, game mechanic, even just like this is the medium, the more you play and the more you have experience, the less playtesting you will have to do because you already know how it's going to work. You just need to then just be checking the human element at some point. And that's a great way to play a bunch of games that are trying out some new stuff and maybe get ideas for how your own playtesting works.
And
Iterate your own playtesting design.
I think in a lot of cases, one of the biggest factors of playtesting is at least the sort of the type where I was saying, like, get it to the table as quick as you can. One of the biggest factors in that, in my opinion, is the getting out of your own head. Like this, the idea of, like, you've been working on this thing for how long? Maybe one or two other people have seen it. Maybe it's only been you, right? The second you put that in front of someone else, it's a different beast because all of these things that you have been stewing on, where you might have, looped yourself into a corner on something that doesn't actually make that much sense because you iterated on it 14 times before you ever showed it to anyone. Those are the kinds of things that I think are huge, even once you get to a point where you can kind of grok how something's gonna, oh, I hate using that word
I
now.
know, but it's he didn't don't I understand.
Sorry, but yeah, where you can kind of understand or get a sense for how something's gonna work, before you get it to the table, you kind of have a feel. But then getting it to the table is where you really see how much of me sitting working on the lonely fun of me designing this, how much of that was me going insane in a room by myself, and how much of it was actually true. So.
Yeah. I think it's rare too. Like, if you have any sort of experience of being a game designer, it's kind of rare that you're going to put something out in front of a player and none of it works. You know, I think that that's the fear. Like, this is going to suck. They're going to hate it. It's much more rare for it to just be a completely sucky experience all the way around. At least, again, in my experience, I've been playing games for a very long time, though. I can imagine that that might happen if you were not as experienced, that we might have more of a chance. But I even then, like, we're humans, we're pretty good at games. It's kind of what we do.
I think it's
There's
easy
always
to
going to be something.
catastrophize when
Yes.
something goes wrong, though. Like, especially when you're new, if you've never made something before and had people play test it, and I've experienced this a couple of times with people who are relatively new to designing, where they've made something, they get it in front of people, it's working, but some element isn't going the way they expected, or it's not going, like, even if there's just a facet that's not going right. And everything else is working really well. I have seen people sort of catastrophize and feel pretty down about it. And I think that's something that you have to kind of be prepared for mentally. Like, this might not all work. Sometimes things aren't going to all just, fit together fully. And that's okay. But that's something you have to kind of mentally prepare yourself for, because it can feel kind of frustrating if you've spent, six months working on something and then you put it in front of someone and it feels like part of the game is falling apart or whatever.
This reminds me, I'm a teacher, and it reminds me so much of like you spend time creating a lesson, and then you put it, I'm a high school teacher too, so I teach the same lesson multiple times a day. And I'm like, oh, I'm gonna try this out. Put it in front of the kids, and something goes terribly wrong. And it can be so easy. And I remember being a new teacher and that happening, being like, oh my God, I'm the worst. Like, this is terrible. What do I do? What do I do? And freeze. With more experience, now I know, like, oh, okay, hold on. This isn't working. Let's try this instead. Let's redo this. Like, let's start over. And then the next time I teach the lesson, it's even better. I always tell my first period freshmen, you're my guinea pigs today. You have to be the worst. And I get to be the worst because you are the worst. And then we iterate that way. It's so similar. Game design, That's the best way to be a game designer. Come be a teacher. You have to game design every day.
I know a lot of teachers who make games.
Unironically. All teachers make games.
Well,
every
true,
teacher
yeah.
makes games. Every teacher is a game designer, but professionally.
Yeah.
It's so natural.
Yeah, it's fascinating.
One of the things that I find most interesting in the iteration process is when we're talking about like, okay, we've got the game. I've worked this thing out. Nobody's seen it yet. I'm going to put it in front of people. And then kind of expanding from Chase's comment about like, it's doing this thing that I didn't expect. Mm-hmm. Well, is that thing that I didn't expect cool? Like, was this a happy accident that my game suddenly spawned a really cool idea based on the ingredients that I put in there? And do I want to kind of, you know, re-examine my game with that new bit of information in mind that like the players really latched onto this thing about the mechanics, or they started interacting with each other in this way that I didn't really plan for. Mm-hmm. And, you know, taking the time to decide whether, you know, you want to try to incorporate that, or if you want to try to refine the game back to get that thing out, because that's not something you want to be part of the game, you know, harkens to having a clear goal for what you want the game to be, like having defined it for yourself in your head. But right. I think that the longer the game is in your head before you put it in front of people and get that result, the harder it is for you to embrace the potential accidents, because you become so dependent on this is what the game is. I've been living with it for this whole time. All this work I've been doing has been leading me to get this kind of a game experience, or I want the mechanics to work this way, or whatever it is. And then when it doesn't do that, it feels like, well, it's the sunk time fallacy. I've put all this time into making it go do this thing that I need to refine it now to make sure that it still does that thing, because I dedicated myself to creating a game that does that thing. And you might be less inclined to, you know, embrace the happy accident of like, oh, like one thing that I recognized when I was running playtests for Capers way back in the day was I was primarily focused on just making sure the mechanics work. You're doing a card flipping thing and it's a press your luck kind of gambling game. And at the end of the first playtest, the players made it very clear that their favorite part of the game was like, I was telling this lovely story and they had fun characters and there's a great villain and we had a cool action sequence, and their favorite part of the game was like counting cards for each other and and cheering each other on when I know you've got a lot of face cards left in your deck. So come on, keep going, keep flipping cards, you know, like it's going to benefit you. And it became the craps table mentality where everybody bets with the shooter. And in a game where you're playing cooperatively, that's what you're doing. Everybody is betting with the shooter. Everybody wants the person rolling dice to get the 20 or to get the three sixes or whatever it is you need to get for the game. And so I leaned into that, and I was concerned about, well, do I want to say in the rules that counting cards is okay? Can you look through your discard? Like I was concerned that like there'll be players who are good at kind of keeping track of that stuff, and then some players who aren't. Will they feel like they're losing out if they're not good at doing that sort of thing? Am I robbing that player of the fun? And ultimately it was like, no, it's not about them individually. It's about them as a group. Mm-hmm. Kind of cheering on the person or saying, be careful, you know, like your deck's looking awful thin, and we've already seen a lot of face cards. There's a lot of low cards in there. Your bad joker is still in that deck somewhere. Like, you know, you're nudging them the other way. And so after that first couple of rounds of playtest, when people were saying stuff like that, I reexamined like, oh, I got to make sure that everything I write about this game builds that. Mm-hmm. I want.
Yeah.
You know, like it, in addition to the other things that I can do, because this is like a whole side thing. It, having that happen doesn't affect anything else about the game. It doesn't mess up the mechanics. It doesn't make the story about something else. It doesn't screw around with characters. So those are the things I you know, people sometimes refer to it as when the game teaches you what it is, mm-hmm. Rather than you deciding what the game is. And I love when I find those, and I've had those moments with a few games where it's like, oh, there's a very clear thing that I need to kind of make an adjustment for, because the game just taught me, oh, this awesome cool thing happens a lot.
Yeah.
And it's a fun aspect of the game when it happens, so I want to make sure to encourage it. I want to make sure statistically it pops up enough, or I want to encourage players to take the actions that result in that thing. so that they're being willing to take the risks to get that thing because it's a cool part of the game. And so, you know,
yeah,
that's a big part of iterating. And it's one of the things that I kind of miss a little bit when I do iterations of whole systems, because like the game mechanic, it's established. I'm not planning on changing major components of the game mechanic. It's all just fine tuning like little subsystems and things. So I don't see that sort of thing happen as often as when I'm initially developing the game system.
Well, because you don't have it in front of a group and it's a group game. Until you have it in a group, it's not.
And you don't, and like, you've already discovered, if there's something like that to discover, you've probably already discovered it.
Yeah.
in the first, second, or third version of the roll track system, rather than the fourth version of the roll track system, which, you know, is things that so I went so far as to like change a major component about how the game functions, and I had to kind of look for that again. And
I think that the
fun moment that's kind of an accident.
Yeah. Yeah. The fascinating flip side of that, I think, too, is like when you find those moments where something doesn't quite work, I think it's interesting. You found one where like something did work in an interesting way, like things were like came together to build something you didn't expect. And I think the flip side is when something comes together and makes something that doesn't work in a way that you didn't expect. And I think the common phrase that I always hear people say is like, kill your darlings or whatever. And it's so easy, exactly like what you were saying. When you've been working on it forever by yourself and you have this very strong idea of what the system should be, and you're unwilling to like drop this element because it's so dear to you. And I think especially for younger, newer designers who haven't spent as much time making games and doing playtesting, it can be really hard to be like, oh, this thing that I hold so dearly, that I love this mechanic, I either need to fully rework it or just drop it because the game is way better for it. And it's sort of the inverse of what you were saying, but I think I have seen it happen in so many of the games I've worked on, both video game and tabletop stuff. And I've seen it in other people's games. I've seen things where I'm like, oh, this game is fantastic, but I think this is a darling they should have killed. Like it's a little element that just doesn't quite fit in with everything else. And if you dropped it all, the whole thing would like come together much cleaner. And I think that's an interesting aspect that I find is really important for like newer designers as well, is to be willing to re-examine your designs when something doesn't quite work. But it's hard. I mean, it's hard.
Yeah. And the thing to keep in mind is that nothing you cut is ever really gone.
Yeah.
You know, we talk about it on the show all the time. I'll take that thing. I'll put it up on the shelf. Didn't quite work for this game. Maybe it'll work in another game. Maybe that's a cool thing that will actually be a feature rather than something that's kind of getting in the way of the fun.
I started keeping a huge slush document after I was in like the Dice Exploder Discord, and Lady Tabletop in there was talking about how that's what she keeps like this huge Google Doc that's just full. I was like, that's a good idea because everything's just so everywhere right now. And so now I do the exact same thing where whenever I cut something that I really love or think of a new idea, I just append a new like mechanical thing. So
that was one of the first pieces of game advice that I'd ever gotten. Like before I started thinking like, oh, I can actually design my own game instead of just writing like adventures for other people's games. Mm-hmm. Was Elisa Teague was doing a workshop and said she has a notebook of ideas for mechanics and then another section in it that's just like ideas for stories or like ideas for like the vibe, I guess, is what you would there was a specific word for it, but it was board game specific and I don't remember the premise, the theme, and then sometimes those, when she puts them in there, sometimes they work together well, or sometimes they just stay in the notebook. And I was like, yes, I will do this now. And now I do that. Yeah. And that's been very, very helpful for me. So rare win, first game design advice actually working out.
I used to just kind of keep it all everywhere. I would just like write random notes when I had ideas and it was just never collated, but I do the exact same thing now. Like I have a big list of mechanics and a big list of themes. I'm very similar now.
Well, Chase, this has been a great conversation. And Craig, you're some sort of psychic. We could talk about this for 7 hours. just like you said very beginning. we do have to wrap up here. Does anyone have any final thoughts on playtesting before we go?
I mentioned it during the episode, but I think the biggest thing is just go playtest. Like if you have a half-baked idea that's not quite done, go like call up three of your friends, get them to the table, buy a pizza, and just playtest it. Like you'll learn so much about it. You'll get inspired to make more other games or finish what that is or whatever. Like just get something to a table.
Totally.
Learning is fun, and playtesting is a great way to learn.
Yeah, yeah.
Totally. It's part of the game design process. Part of the process. Chase, thank you so much again for coming on the show. Thank you. Where can we find you and your work?
So I'm on Blue Sky at CH Kirk, K-U-R-K, and you can find all of my stuff under Story Games Chicago's itch.io. So if you just Google Story Games Chicago, you should be able to find our website, our itch.io, all sorts of stuff. We have Vesta Mandate right now. You can buy that on IPR, all sorts of itch, all that sort of stuff. I'm kickstarting a game called Diabolic Dialect, a little Oops All Spells Wizards game right now. So that's pretty much all my stuff.
Very interestingly enough, I have the Ashcan playtest little zine thing for Diabolic Dialect right here on my table as well.
Oh, nice. Damn, you got all my stuff.
I do have literally all the Story Game Chicago stuff.
That's so awesome. I almost forgot to mention, I also have a podcast called Game Storm that I have another episode coming out soon, which I guess I don't know when this is going out exactly. So I'll probably still have episodes coming out soon whenever this comes out. But we're in our second season. It's all Chicago-based designers. And each episode is we build a new game live on air. So
cool.
So check that out too.
Awesome. You can find me on Blue Sky. I'm Joska there, and I'm also Joska on Discord. And you can find my games at wannabegames.itch.io. Kings of Dreamsport, the Kingsport Mysteries from Arkham Horror's RPG is out, and one of my adventures, one of my mysteries for Arkham Horror is there. A game that I used to love when I was in college. I played the board game and the card game, and now they have a role playing game, and I get to write for it. Woo! So exciting! That's out.
Awesome.
And you can go check that out and go read the mystery that I was told was too gruesome. Please change this. And I had to. Yeah, so that's me.
You can find me at Nerdburger Craig on Blue Sky. The website is nerdburgergames.com. There's a web store there where you can buy everything, including the fancy schmancy versions of some of the bigger games with their nice hardcovers. And then the games are also available at drivethroughrpg.com. This is the 10-year anniversary of Nerdburger Games. Yeehaw! There's stuff coming up about that.
The cowboy theme for Nerdburger Games this year.
Secrets of the Vibrant Sky is wrapping up playtesting and in editing. So, you know, probably do a little adjustment. Might be like a touch more playtesting. Might just be myself. Might just sit down and be like, okay, did I fix the things that people said were a little bit of a problem, and so that'll be coming to Kickstarter in not too long. That's the third book in the Vibrant Realms game. It brings the story of your character full circle. You can play it standalone, or you can play it in conjunction with the other games. And then also, Cosmic Corsairs is sitting in a warehouse along with all but one of its accessories. The dice are still en route to the warehouse, but as soon as they are there, we'll be fulfilling that Kickstarter. And that means Cosmic Corsairs and all the bits and pieces that go along with it will be available for purchase to those people who didn't or couldn't back the Kickstarter. So Cosmic Corsairs will be in the world by my birthday at the end of March, I would imagine.
I just realized why it's called a warehouse. Anyway, sometimes you learn things and you're 34 and it was stupid of you to have learned that it's a house for your wares. Why? Why did I not think of that until just now? Okay, thank you to our opening and closing theme song, which is available by Steph Sax, licensed under a Creative Commons license. Thank you, Steph Sax, and thank all of you for listening, and we'll see you back here next time. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.